This is WJBC This Week.
I am not going to attend the convention in Cleveland. I'm going to focus here in Illinois.
Now I'm going to have to walk a block and a half to two blocks to catch a bus. And then I'll have to get off of that bus and get on another bus.
3% is a modest increase. It really is only a tad above inflationary costs.
We've been working for more than 300 days without payment. Collectively, we're owed over $100 million.
Our office was responsible for 352,000 visitors coming into the area.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, reaction from a Republican Party strategist as Donald Trump essentially wraps up the party's nomination for president. An author looks back at what prompted the Kent State shootings as we mark the anniversary this week. We get a Labor Day lesson from Illinois Appeals Court Justice Robert Steigman. A Bloomington teen who becomes a nationally acclaimed figure skater will be performing in Bloomington next week. Plus, organizers roll out plans for a new Illinois Basketball Hall of Fame in Central Illinois. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Donald Trump now looking to broaden his base of Republican support after essentially wrapping up the GOP nomination for president this week. Many in the party establishment are moving the Donald's way, but some say they still aren't ready to support him. Former Illinois Republican Party Chairman Pat Brady discusses the quandary some of the party face and how a likely Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton race for the White House could impact other races in Illinois, as Brady talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
So you're not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, so are you just not going to vote for president? Because I've talked to people who have said that. I've talked to people who said they will vote for Donald Trump. And I was kind of surprised because I think up until a few weeks ago, they said they would never do that. So what are you going to do? Just not vote for anyone?
I'm going to focus my efforts on the places that we've done well, including Mark Kirk in the Senate race. People don't realize in the last 7 years, we've picked up 900 legislative seats in the country, 12 governorships, House and the Senate. So we've had a pretty good run below the presidential level. I just want to do everything I can to mitigate the damage that this guy at the top of the ticket is going to do below the presidential race.
Do you think if he were to get, let's say, a Newt Gingrich as a running mate, that would help? Would you call Newt a true conservative? I mean, because I hear from my conservative friends all the time, there are no real true conservatives anymore. And they always bring up, the days of Reagan and Newt Gingrich.
You know, Gingrich was way after Reagan, and I wish Newt Gingrich would get off the stage because I don't think he helps us. A mid-70s white guy talking the same stuff we've been talking for 30 years. It might be good for Trump, but it's not good. In 1980, when Reagan won, 12% of the voting population was non-white. Now it's close to 33%, and we are not attracting those people that we need to win, and that's why we're getting creamed. When Reagan ran, it was a very positive, optimistic message of inclusion, shining city on the hill, strong national defense, foreign policy, and a growing economy. I mean, it's just the opposite now with Trump, and quite honestly, with some of the stuff we've heard about from Republicans in the last 5 or 6 years.
Now, the Associated Press was saying some higher-ups in the Republican Party are getting together today to try and come up with a third-party candidate. Why don't they do this? Because Wright said he's the candidate. Let's back him. Why not work with Trump to bring in a running mate that will, I don't know, calm some people?
And who
would that be? Who would that be?
The only one that I think that could do that is Paul Ryan, but nobody wants to commit political suicide by hitching their wagon to Trump. And again, my issue with him is not personality or who he is. He's so far out of the Republican mainstream, I can't support him. On the third party run, the analysis I saw last night and what I read, it's almost impossible now because it's so late in the process because of the filing requirements to get on the ballot. So this third party talk, I don't know what it means, but I don't think it's really viable.
He is so unconventional in everything he does. It doesn't hurt him. When he kidded, and I didn't take it literally when he said, you know, I'm so popular I could shoot somebody on 7th Avenue and my poll numbers would go up. But he could be involved in a sex scandal right now, and I don't think it would hurt him. And how many sex scandals have taken down good people?
So I just was up in the federal courthouse last week watching one of the most sickening sex scandals I've ever seen in my life with our former Republican speaker. And you want to talk about an era where the Republicans, along with the president, went along with too much spending. It was in the 2000s. So I get and respect and understand anger about what Republican elected officials have done at some level. But the answer is not to put in a guy who does not represent any of our values.
All right. What I saw a survey, I think it was Rasmussen, asked the question, and one of their options was not even to show up to the polls. If Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are the two main party nominees, only 6% said that they wouldn't even bother going. That would be good news for the Republicans, because Republicans have to be concerned about losing House and Senate seats if people stay home.
Yeah, everybody's got to show up to vote. And, you know, when I say my time about values, I know that I don't even like using that term. To me, what Trump the damage is just a basic competency and interest in learning the issues like foreign policy and national security. But we as Republicans have to show up. If we don't show up, we're going to hand the whole thing over to the Clintons, and that's never good.
Is there, I asked before, and I don't know if maybe I hung up on you and never got the answer. Is there someone you have in mind that may allow Donald Trump to beat Hillary Clinton as a running mate?
You know, I'm not sure if there's anybody, like I said before, that wants to hitch their wagon on that. But here's, I think, another reality, which is scary to me, that I could see an alignment with Trump's people and some of the Bernie people. And, you know, Trump's already way to the left on foreign policy, national security. And the big issue is this trade issue. You heard him last night talking about NAFTA. And he's right where Bernie is, and he's right where Ross Perot was in 92. I don't think it's going to happen, but I could see it happening where these people all – Hillary's the second most unpopular major party nominee
right.
in our country's history. So it could happen. I just think that the VP choice, although important because they're both in their 70s, will be less impactful – for Trump, because he's going to suck all the oxygen out of the room.
Tell me if I'm crazy. Did the Clinton people need to be concerned about Bernie Sanders people voting for Donald Trump?
Yes, they do. And if you talk to people other than the people you see on television, the operatives, they see for Republicans, even in Illinois, upside to Trump being on the ballot down ticket, that some of these Democrats that just don't like the Clintons are going to come over and vote Republican, which could do a lot to help Illinois Republicans in the downstate House seats. I think that it's going to be a tough year for us because the map is what it is, but some real smart people are Democrats see big risk in Trump being the top of the ticket for down ticket downstate Illinois.
That was Republican Party strategist Pat Brady with Scott Laughlin. It was 46 years ago this week when student protests on the campus of Kent State University in Ohio turned tragic. After the protests turned to chaos and the Ohio National Guard fired into a crowd of protesters, killing 4 people and wounding 9 others. Howard Means, author of the book 67 Shots, Kent State and the End of American Innocence, talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
Was Kent State and the student activist movement on that campus in any way unique?
It wasn't unique, no. It was surprising to a lot of people because while Kent State was a school of 21,000 people, it was basically a regional school. There was still, in many ways, its primary job in many ways was still to prepare high school teachers, public school teachers for Northeast Ohio. So there was this sort of, you know, it was a big, big campus. It was under the radar, but there had been a lot of student protest activity there. The Students for Democratic Society had a very active chapter there until the end of late 1969 when it was suspended, when the charter was revoked. So it wasn't a unique campus in that regard. What made it unique were the couple things. One, there was a huge town-gown divide. The school had simply outgrown the community. It scared a lot of the people. The people in Kent were expecting the worst, And when there was some minor, when there was bad behavior downtown on Friday night by a lot of students, in some cases criminal behavior, but to a lot of people in Kent, it confirmed the worst, that, you know, that the onslaught had begun, the revolution was there, and the mayor of the town overreacted to what was really, it was the first warm weekend in spring, there was too much beer involved, there was too much everything involved, and the Vietnam War protests sparked by the Nixon address the night before made matters sort of more volatile than they might have been otherwise. But in the middle of the wee hours of the morning, the mayor called Governor Jim Rhodes' office, the Ohio governor, and first inquired about the National Guard and mentioned that Students for a Democratic Society had been behind a lot of the protests downtown. And those two factors took it to another level.
Well, I want to talk about Governor Jim Rhodes and how he used the National Guard in a way and his reaction to this for his own political ends in just a second. But by the time the governor was asked to assist in this, we should probably talk about the moments of escalation, because there were tensions that led up to men with guns being called in and being on edge only a few days before what happened with the shooting. There was an ROTC building that was burned down.
Yep. And it was not uncommon to burn down ROTC buildings or to try to burn them down on American campuses in the late 60s. It was the most, you know, it was the most visible symbol on campus of American military power. And in many cases, they were buildings easy to light on fire. They'd, you know, wooden structures that had gone up in a hurry in World War II. Often they were sort of off on the edge of campus, too, so they didn't present a fire hazard to a lot of other buildings. But all that said, it should have been perfectly obvious to the administration of Kent State University that this building was a target. There was a sign Friday. The building is lit on fire Saturday night and burns to the ground. But on Friday, there had been a sign on campus, prominently displayed on campus, why is the ROTC building still standing? And 24 hours later, a little more than 24 hours later, it wasn't standing anymore. But the university made no attempt to protect the building. Even when firefighters showed up from the city of Kent, and there, in some cases, again, in four or five instances, their hoses, their fire hoses, were attacked with machetes and other knives, picks, ice picks, that sort of thing. And there was a campus police force. There was a 30-person campus police force that made no attempt to intervene and protect it. So the university consistently sent the wrong signal to students and consistently, I think, made the wrong choices.
We're talking with Howard Means. His book, 67 Shots, is about the Kent State clash between the Ohio National Guard and student protesters, which led to a shooting, including four fatalities. So, Howard, let's get back a little bit to the political ambitions of Ohio Governor Jim Rhodes and how he used this moment to essentially try to help his own campaign. He was leaving the governor's mansion and he was running for, I believe, Senate.
Right.
And at the time, you know, a lot of voters were uneasy about these student protests, uneasy about the disruption of order. What did Governor Rhodes decide to do, and what were his motivations?
Well, Jim Rhodes was a law and order governor, Republican law and order governor, had fairly high national standing. He was very much in the mode of Ronald Reagan out in California, who had made his reputation as a law and order governor out there, standing up to student protesters at places like Berkeley, UCal Berkeley. So Jim Rhodes is locked in a tight senatorial primary campaign. The primary election is scheduled for Tuesday, May 5. He gets this request in the early morning hours of Saturday, May 2, or this inquiry about bringing the National Guard to Kent. From his point of view, logistically, it was easy because there was already a National Guard unit involved in trying to broker the Teamsters strike in Akron, just about 10, 15 miles away. And Jim Rhodes' natural constituency was this sort of southern Ohio Republicans, and he wanted to activate his base, just like, you know, politicians today want to activate their base. This gave him a chance to do it. He had the guard nearby. He orders the guard to come to Kent. The guard itself declares that it's only going to come if it can marshal law in both Kent and the campus. So on Saturday night, Jim Rhodes and his opponent, Robert Taft Jr., son of Robert Taft, the famous Mr. Republican, have their last debate. Jim Rhodes is trailing when that debate gets underway, he's trailing in the polls by about 70,000 votes. On Tuesday, when the election is held, he loses by 5,000 votes. So he did activate his base by doing this, and he darn near carried it all the way to the Senate Republican primary. I mean, to the Senate Republican nomination for the seat. So it served Jim Rhodes' purposes beautifully to have this happen. The problem is that the card came in such massive force that by Sunday afternoon, the students were no longer protesting the Vietnam War. They were protesting the fact that their campus had been taken over by the National Guard. And that's really what sets the stage for the horror of Monday.
What's kind of ironic and interesting about the National Guard and the actual guardsmen that would come in into conflict with these protesters is, at the time, some people joined the National Guard to try and avoid service in Vietnam. So I'm sure it wasn't the case for
right.
I'm sure it wasn't the case for every guardsman that was on duty that day. But you have the National Guard essentially brought in over the fear of protesters protesting Vietnam, and the guard is consisting of several people that joined the National Guard so they wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. It's a weird irony.
It's a weird irony. And on Sunday, after the guard arrives while the ROTC building's burning on Saturday, there's a big confrontation later that evening at the main gates of the university. But by Sunday, things had settled down, and everybody talks about it having almost a beach party atmosphere in lots of cases. There are wonderful photographs of the guards and the students, you know, talking, sharing cigarettes, et cetera. And it looked for a while there that it was going to be, you know, everything would sort of peter out. The students would go back to being students. The guards would go back to, you know, to their jobs, in some cases being students, school teachers, whatever they were. But then there's another huge confrontation on Sunday night, again at these gates. And by then, the guard is in such mass. And on Sunday night, they're just helicopters flying all over the place, dropping tear gas in some cases, shining spotlights down. And it just militarized. It militarized a civilian disturbance. And ultimately, a military solution got applied because these guardsmen are equipped basically for crowd control with M1 battle rifles, lethal to half a mile, with bayonets and with tear gas. So there's no sort of middle ground. There are no rubber bullets. There are no water cannons, the sort of things you saw elsewhere at that point. So the stage was set for Monday afternoon, and with tragic results.
That was author Howard Means with Steve Fast. We marked Law Day this week on the 50th anniversary of the case of Miranda versus Arizona. Illinois Appellate Court Judge Robert Steigman talked to McLean County lawyers this week. I'd also talk with WJBC's Dan Swaney about the landmark case and how the legal system can and should be improved.
Can you explain exactly what it means?
Sure. Essentially, that's when the United States Supreme Court said, in order to provide additional protections for people in custody, and you have to remember, it applies only to a custodial interrogation. What does that mean? That means you're in custody. The police have arrested you. You're in a police station or in a police car or whatever, and they want to ask you questions. The Miranda rights that the Supreme Court now mandates is before they can ask you questions and take answers from you that might be incriminating, they must tell you what your rights are, such as, do you have the right to remain silent? You don't have to talk to us at all. And to tell you, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult with a lawyer before you speak to me. And if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you at no cost to you.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the essential Miranda rights. Now, you're supposed to take a waiver. It should be one step beyond that, where I'd say, Mr. Swaney, do you understand what I've just explained to you? And say yes. And understanding that, do you still wish to talk to me? It's one of the areas where it's a little tricky because sometimes the police aren't so good on eliciting the waiver, and that creates some problems. But essentially, what we're trying to do is, what the Supreme Court tried to do, is make sure that before a suspect in a custodial interrogation speaks voluntarily to the police, he is knowingly and intelligently giving up his right to remain silent or to consult with a lawyer. In fact, people do this all the time.
And it's something that is portrayed in practically every police show on
sure.
television and movie. It's all right there for you.
Right.
And it seems pretty simple. How can it get screwed up, though?
Well,
it's straightforward to me and you and Kelly.
One of the questions is, when are you in custody? That's one of the things
okay.
I talked about today. For instance, the joke, and I lecture to cops about this subject a lot, and the joke is that some police officers take a guy in handcuffs into the police station behind four different electronically locked doors, sit him down in a room with no windows, and he's down in the basement someplace with a desk and a chair, and they sit him down, take off the handcuffs, and say, "You're not in custody. We're not arresting you." Well, the question is, what would a reasonable man, not innocent of any crime, think? And is this a detention? And so we have a lot of litigation like that, and cops are still doing that. And one of the things I lecture to them is say, you know, that doesn't work. My message is, if you want to conduct a non-custodial interrogation, why is that important? Because then you don't have to give them the Miranda warnings. Instead of taking them to the cop shop, take them to the Burger King. Sit in the back booth. Have a hamburger and a strawberry shake. So when he says afterwards, "Gee, I thought I was compelled to answer," the response of the judge would most likely be to just laugh.
Yeah.
As opposed to sitting in the police station.
Makes sense to me. Are lawyers and the legal system in general portrayed fairly in the media these days?
I can't stand it. I can't watch TV shows and I can't watch movies when they portray courtroom stuff. And as a matter of fact, they teach at law school, and I have to tell law students, what you see is not what happens. And mostly, it's not so much the lawyers as the courtroom proceedings. And I'll concede that, you know, Hollywood writers have to take liberties, but the liberties are so awful. It primarily concerns then, and I know you've seen some courtroom activity, it concerns terrible misconduct by lawyers in court and judges who are too stupid or gutless to stop it. And it's not the way things work. And I can understand why people who have no experience with the criminal or civil justice system, but just see what happens on TV or movie portrayals, would think this system is not fair, doesn't work, it's filled with charlatans and the rest. It really isn't. And the best antidote is to have had jury service or to talk to someone who's had jury service, because these people almost invariably will say, you know, that was really a meaningful experience and I learned so much and I was so impressed with the fairness and the reasonableness of the court system.
And it's not like The Good Wife or any of the other shows you see.
Can't stand it.
The Good Wife in particular is just stupid in the court.
What they portray is just so wrong and so awful. And it's I'm glad you asked this, because people who haven't had the experience and are just watching these shows probably think, gee, this must be the way it is. It isn't. As a matter of fact, they can't watch it unless I'm handcuffed, because otherwise I'm going to throw ashtrays through the TV.
Judge Bob Stagman said that. He's been talking to us here this half hour. As always, very candid, very straightforward in what he thinks about things. If you could wave the Bob Stagman magic wand, what would you fix first in the legal system these days?
Well, it's hard to say. In the civil cases, one of my problems is with my fellow judges in particular. I don't think they're sufficiently respectful of the time of the litigants who appear in their courtroom or the costs of civil litigation. Too often, and I've been saying this for over 40 years, too often we have judges who view lawyers as their handmaidens. You know, I'm the high priest and you're here to wait on me. That's exactly wrong. Judges should view themselves as public servants, like the guy behind the counter in the Secretary of State's office, only performing a specialized function in a specialized uniform. We serve the public typically through the lawyers, not citizens themselves, because it's a tricky business. So what does that mean? That means we should do everything we can to try to make things more efficient, more effective, less costly for the lawyers, because that will reflect on what they charge their clients. Judges don't do that sufficiently, in my judgment. They never have. There are too many, when I've raised this subject with my fellow judges, who look at me like I'm crazy. What are you talking about? Hey, I was there. It's kind of, you know, it reminds me of fraternity hazing. I was never in a fraternity, but I saw it happen, where people who were freshmen and went through fraternity hazing hated it, spoke ill of it, and thought it was stupid, and then it became upperclassmen and thought, well, I survived it, now I'm going to inflict it on the next guy. Well, you know, at some point, someone's got to be an adult and say, let's stop this.
That was Appellate Court Judge Robert Steigman with Dan Swaney. Today's local news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Alex Wellman of Bloomington didn't learn how to skate until grade school. He took a learning to skate class at the Pepsi Ice Center. Now he's nearly in a class by himself. Last winter, the 16-year-old won a silver medal at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships in Minnesota for the intermediate age group. He'll also be performing at an event hosted by the Central Illinois Figure Skating Club at the Pepsi Ice Center next Saturday, May 14th. Alex and the club's Lena Chaudhry talk with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Alex, tell me when this became more than a hobby for you.
I still think of it as my hobby because I enjoy it so much, but it really started to become more than just a hobby when I started to take private lessons with my coach, Madeline.
Mm-hmm. She's been here in the studio before. She talks very highly of you. Was Madeline there saying, hey, I see something that if you really wanted to make this bigger, you could, or did it just evolve naturally?
Oh, no, she definitely approached me, especially in Learn to Skate when I did jump and spin class, and I really loved that class, so she really saw that I had a passion for the sport.
And you were how old when you took your first Learn to Skate class?
Oh, I was maybe 7 or 8, so I was pretty old for a figure skater.
And that's the reality now, is that so many Olympic athletes really start in training in their toddler years. Lena,
two.
Your daughter is also a competitive figure skater.
Yes.
How old was she when she started?
She started about the same age. Both of them, Alex and Maisha, have started skating later than usual. But she started about seven, yeah.
But both are catching up very quickly. Alex, so you can explain to everybody, including myself, how far you have risen in the skating world. What was the last award that you received?
Well, the last award that I received was second at Nationals, which was an amazing honor.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a big deal. That's the same national competition that feeds into the Olympic program, correct?
Yes, but I competed at a couple levels lower than the Olympic level.
Because you're in what they call the junior novice or novice? Where is the level?
It's intermediate.
Intermediate,
yes, intermediate.
Okay. Where does that progress to? Is there another level than before you would be qualifying for the Olympics?
Yes, so when I placed second, I was at the intermediate level, mm-hmm. but this season I moved up to novice, and then after novice, there's junior, and then senior, the Olympic level.
Boys age differently in skating than girls do.
Yes.
Because it's good for you to go through puberty and become stronger and taller, whereas the girls, they want everybody to be as small and as tiny as long as they can. Is that not true, Lena?
No. I think that perception is changing.
Is it?
Because more and more mature skaters are placing well in the world.
Well, that's good.
And the sport, because of the sport physiology changes in how it is being approached has changed in our country and some other parts of the world, but what you were saying is true in many other parts of the world, too. They want the girls to be very tiny and remain and such, so their skating is not affected.
Well, it's one of those things that coaches and consultants will bring up when they're trying to figure out where is your sweet spot for age and competition. So is there a timeline at all for you? Alex, you're 16 now, as to when you hope to get to the top level? By what age?
Maybe 18, 19, 20. It's definitely not in the immediate future, mm-hmm. but it's definitely in the future.
But you have the time to get there.
Yes, I do have the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So is there a certain number on the Olympic scale that is a goal for you, or am I just the only one saying Olympics to you?
Oh, no, you're not the only one, but I like to take every day one day at a time and mm-hmm. not really put that much stress on me to say that I have to make the Olympics or I have to do this by this date.
Who's your favorite figure skater? Who do you role model in the men's figure skating world?
Men's figure skating world? I really like Javier Fernandez, who's the reigning world champion.
And
fabulous.
He's
got a couple of quads in his repertoire, does he not?
Yes, all the top men have multiple quads.
So let's go back to Dad here for a second, because I've talked to Lena before about watching her daughter fly up into the air when she's learning a lot of these high jumps and kind of dangerous tricks. Do you, Luke, or your wife, when you're watching Alex out on the ice, when he's spinning, which can sometimes end badly, are you ever in fear watching Alex skate?
You know, no, I've not been in fear watching him skate because of just how he's evolved through the sport and knowing, you know, he has had bumps and bruises and mm-hmm. he's lived through those and bounced back. So he's done fine with it, and really he has that confidence on the ice that when he goes and does his triple, I have no fear in doing that.
You have a triple. I haven't seen you do a triple. What is it, a triple toe loop, a triple axel?
I have triple sow, lutz.
Flip.
Yes, flip. Those are my favorite.
Lena obviously knows all your triples.
And just to clarify, I get scared with my daughter when she is doing pairs. It's not she's doing singles, because at that time she's up in the air 10 feet, head completely down towards the ice. At that time, is as a mom, you close your eyes and say a prayer.
I can only imagine. What is your training life like, Alex? Because I want to be able to say, you know, hey, I knew that kid when, but I know you're putting in an amazing amount of work while you're also a full-time student. Take me through a day of Alex Wallman.
Well, usually my busiest days are Mondays and Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. So I'll skate in the morning before school for about half an hour, 45 minutes.
At the Pepsi Ice Center?
Yes, at the Pepsi Ice Center around like 6:30. And then I'll head to school and do my core classes. And I'll head back to the rink around 1:50 and skate for 3 hours.
And do you have to do other classes, skating, like dance classes or working out in a gym or something on top of the ice
usually
time?
Usually after skating, I'll either go to the dance studio at Stacy's Dance Factory, or I'll go and work out with my trainer.
Is there ever a time for time off for Alex? Do you get to spend any time with your friends or any other activities?
I do, but it's definitely difficult to fit it in sometimes.
That was Alex Wellman and Lena Chaudhry of the Central Illinois Figure Skating Club with Susan Saunders. Plans are developing for a new Illinois Basketball Hall of Fame in Pontiac. It's still in the early planning stages, but the effort got a boost this week with the Illinois Basketball Coaches Association announcement of a new development director, Mark Meyer, a longtime sportscaster in Pontiac, who'll be heading up the fundraising effort. Meyer talked with WJBC this week.
Well, I'm excited because what it is the IBCA was started by Chuck Wroblewski in the early 70s, and it continued to be one of the just dynamos, of course, in the state of Illinois in high school basketball. And, of course, now you see the banquet tonight with 1,250 people in a room here in Bloomington. And we knew we had to someday get a museum. So they're going to put a museum in Pontiac, Illinois, the Basketball Museum of Illinois. We're going to honor the greats of high school basketball, the greats of college, the greats of pros, the greats of junior highs, all the way through, all the way up, and have a lot of fun, boys and girls, and just some neat exhibits as we put together the Basketball Museum of Illinois.
And it sounds like it's pretty close to officially happening, maybe this spring, summer?
What will happen is, Eric, is we're going to kick it off. Our fundraiser will be August 8th, our golf outing. We're flying in PGA Tour professionals. Don't want to mention names just yet, but we got some top guys coming in. And they're going to kick it off with the fundraiser there that day at the Pontiac Elks. They'll do a youth clinic, and then we'll have it all about giving back. And, of course, we'll have the golf outing, and then we'll get a chance to fundraise more. And then later on in the year, the city will start working on the museum, and we'll try to get it put together. I don't want to set up any dates of anything because you know how this all works. But, yeah, we're official. We just got to go to work now.
You have a site then, I take it.
Absolutely. The old Kmart store, I don't want to give feet. We're looking at 30,000 square feet, but that could change into 16 or 20. Depends what the architects. We have a design group I'll meet with again, the DeMaud Group out of Chicago. They did the Caterpillar Visitor Center. They did the Chicago Bears, University of California. They are the best in the country, and we can't wait.
And so it's right on the main drag, right off the interstate, easy access.
Nothing to it. Right off 55, right off 116, and we look at Pontiac. You can take the far part of the state of the west side, get there real easy, southern Illinois, of course, on the east, and northern Illinois. So we're really excited. The museums are just great in Pontiac right now. I was just on the phone with Amtrak, and Amtrak's looking about doing some things with us too. So it's going to be really, really a lot of fun. But more important, it's about giving back and right in your backyard. Larry Dooling goes in tonight. Long time, well-deserved honor from the IBCA. And that's what it should do. It should be designed to give back.
We talked about the central location to some extent, at least for those coming from the Chicago area. But the history the Pontiac has with high school basketball, of course, and with museums. Does that sort of tie into the fit here?
No doubt about it. You know, one thing about it is anybody can put a museum in the air. You got to sustain the museums, and that's the key. Right now, Pontiac's doing 50,000 visitors from all over the country. You heard the mayor talk tonight. So when you have those kind of museums, the city, and, of course, around the state of Illinois to get the recognition, but, you know, we're going to go worldwide. And the thing is, you know, Derrick Rose played in the Pontiac Holiday Tournament. You know, Cliff Alexander played. Jabari, you heard all that. We really want to get involved with high school basketball. But more importantly, too, I want to give back. I want to be after school programs if we can, give back to communities, help out the state of Illinois with a game of basketball, educational-wise. So this is about kids because our future means everything to me, and I want to make sure we have a great reading programs designed. And this whole museum is designed to last for another 15 years. It'll be interactive city, computerized, and the future of high school basketball.
As you've talked about, the fundraising will be really getting underway here soon. How much will it take to get the building open and to sustain it?
You know what? I really figures we can't go over with right now, of course. We've, for a couple years, we had Leitner in town for a fundraiser last year. Christian came in. We've done a lot of things. So there's fundraising. You saw the donor list, of course. But now we're going to go to the corporate guys, the NBA guys. We've talked to some players, you know, the Dwayne Wades and all the different people. So we're excited.
That was Mark Meyer of the Illinois Basketball Coaches Association on WJBC This Week. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Illinois State University's Board of Trustees has approved a 3% increase in tuition and fees for undergraduate students. President Larry Dietz says the lack of a state budget has left the university with a $60 million gap in its own budget.
3% is a modest increase. It really is only a tad above inflationary costs, and so we had to do that to try to make ends meet.
Dietz says the university is also doing some cost-cutting to help fill the gap, but there is still a need for state appropriation more than the stopgap measure approved last month. At a stop in Bloomington, Governor Rauner said he will not be attending the Republican National Convention in Cleveland this summer.
I'm going to focus here in Illinois. I want to travel where I want to go is travel the world on my nickel. I'll pay for it. I want to travel the world going to China, Germany, Brazil, Mexico. I want those companies coming here and growing and investing in Illinois. That's when I travel. That's where I'm going to go. And where I'm going to go is Indiana.
Rauner was asked about a report that he would not be supporting Donald Trump in the race for president. Rauner toured Nord Outdoor Power in Bloomington to mark Small Business Week. Bloomington Normal will have to wait a little longer to find out if Connect Transit will install a new route system. The Board of Trustees delayed a vote this week. It came a day after a public hearing in which some residents, including Richard Anderson, urged the transit board not to cut their route.
My house to the bus is 1 minute. Now I'm going to have to walk a block and a half to two blocks to catch a bus. And then I'll have to get off of that bus and get on another bus out in the middle of nowhere. I don't know where it's going.
Connect Transit General Manager says the delay will put a strain on staff as they'll have less time to get the routes active by fall. A group of social service providers is suing Governor Rauner's administration over unpaid bills. PayNow Illinois has a lawsuit claiming the state owes their 64 service providers more than $100 million for their work done since the budget impasse began in July. Heading the suit is Coalition Chairwoman Andrea Durbin.
We've been working for more than 300 days without payment. We're now in our 11th month of delivery service. Collectively, we're owed over $100 million. And this isn't the way that I'm sure Illinois wants to do business.
A spokesperson for Rauner says he understands the organization's frustration, but the only solution is for the General Assembly to pass a balanced, reform-oriented budget as soon as possible. There have been complaints about the homeless in the area of Mulberry and Main Streets in downtown Bloomington. A bench in that area was coated with tar. Tricia Stiller with the Downtown Bloomington Association says that bench has since been removed.
We do have several seating areas throughout the downtown, and now that the nicer weather is upon us, we do have folks who take up residence in parts of our downtown, and that is one of the areas.
Steele was not certain that is why the bench was damaged. She says Bloomington police are reviewing camera footage from nearby businesses to identify a suspect. A man who repeatedly assaulted a young girl was sentenced in McLean County Court this week to 36 years in prison. Judge Paul Lawrence handed down the sentence for 35-year-old Nelson Lucero Molina. He pleaded guilty in March to 3 counts of sexual assault. Prosecutors say the man will be deported to Guatemala when he gets out of prison. And the Bloomington Normal Area Convention and Visitors Bureau has announced that tourists spent over $352 million in McLean County in the last year. Director Crystal Howard says the new Route 66 Visitor Center inside the McLean County Museum of History played a big part in bringing visitors.
From April of last year until April of this year, we've had over 18,000 visitors visit that visitor center. So it has far exceeded our expectations. And we're delighted, and we're looking at other ways to market it so we can increase that even more in the next year.
Howard says McLean County ranks 8th in the state for the most tourist revenue. She adds her office was responsible for bringing in more than 350,000 visitors. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Bloomington's City Council will consider a feasibility study for tax increment financing district for a portion of downtown. Also Monday, students at the Regional Alternative School in Bloomington will unveil a colorful addition to the west side of Bloomington with a new mural they've created. On Wednesday, the District 87 and Unit 5 school boards will hold their final meetings before the end of the school year. On Friday, the Normal Corn Belters minor league baseball team will open their 7th season with a game against the Joliet Slammers. WJBC will be live from the corn crib that day. And on Saturday, members of the autism community will gather in Uptown Normal to recreate a human autism logo to mark autism awareness. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.